Support comes from Missouri Forest Products Association, committed to sustainable and sound conservation of the state's forests, which support more than 41,000 Missouri jobs, resulting in a $10 billion industry. Choosewood.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha.
But even worse, she hadn't told me about vowels. I still to this day find vowels very intriguing. And she'd say, but it was all for the good. And I would say to her, no, it was for the good that I made of it. I used to pretend I was both Charlotte Bronte and Jane Eyre. Okay.
Be it spoken or written word, Jamaica Kincaid's voice is unmistakable. The Antiguan American author is at home with many forms of writing, short stories, novels, essays, creative nonfiction. And her work, which has been translated into nearly a dozen languages, has a home on bookshelves around the world, including St. Louis. Kincaid is here in town this week to take in some sights, which we'll touch upon later, and to receive the 2024 St. Louis Literary Award from the St. Louis University Libraries. Her works include the novel Annie John and the book-length essay A Small Place. Past recipients of the award, who have also been guests on the show, include Margaret Atwood, Salman Rushdie, Stephen Sondheim, and last year's winner, Neil Gaiman. Jamaica, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
You were born in St. John's, Antigua.
Yes.
And lived there until you were 16 years old. Jamaica, why did you leave?
To say I left is not quite accurate. I was sent away. Mm-hmm. After my 16th birthday, before I was 17, but almost, to be au pair, a nanny, a servant. In any case, I was sent to take care of four little girls, mm-hmm. In North America.
Yeah.
I think it's something that continues. Affluent people in America will want someone to take care of their children, and they look for people like me. And my family at that time had just fallen into a level of poverty that we had not had before, because my parents had one more child than they could afford.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me to work, and yeah. I would have sent my salary back to help support the family.
Mission. Right.
Yes.
So what is it that you left behind?
Oh, well, the great thing I left behind was my education. I had been what they call a very bright child, and I was always at the top of my class, and always did well in everything. I had been apprenticed to a seamstress, for instance. Mm. And though I wasn't very good at it, I could have been a seamstress one day, or I could have been a teacher. I could have been a lot of things. But I was just, what I left behind was a future that I had a certain possession over, a certain way of life that I thought I could handle. And then suddenly I was just sent away with this family that I didn't know at all.
Mm-hmm.
To live in a climate I was not familiar with, mm-hmm. except in a book.
Right, right.
I'd read about winter.
So, I mean, among all the things then that you could have done, how did writing become the thing that you do?
Silver linings and all that. I'd always loved reading, and at one point, In my career as a reader, as a child, I began to pretend that I had written the things I read. Almost no one who knew me as a child is surprised I became a writer because they said I was always writing. I don't remember writing so much, except I remember thinking sometime between 9, 10, and 11, no later than 11, I was given Jane Eyre to read.
Ah.
And I used to pretend I was both Charlotte Bronte and Jane Eyre.
Okay.
and so I would pretend that's the one time I can remember I identified as an aspiration. But in those days, you know, I hadn't read a book written in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Serious literature stopped with Rudyard Kipling. The things I read, the books I read would be, you know, Penguin, paperbacks, Perry Mason, Lady Chatterley's Daughter,
uh-huh.
which was a pornographic version.
Right.
And which I enjoyed much more than Lady Chatterley's Lover. When I came to America, the first thing I did was to get a high school diploma at night and joined the library, resumed in my own way my education, including stealing a book from the library in Scarsdale or Mamaroneck, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, it was one of those books by the Swedish sociologist, I think Gunnar Myrdal, and it was about a race in America. When I came to America, I didn't understand race. I didn't. For me, white people were British people, and the other people, Spanish people, Portuguese, Italians, mm-hmm. Poles, they were not really white people.
Right.
So I didn't understand when I met all these people who said they were white, I didn't take them seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the ideas of white spaces and so on, it never occurred to me that I was in a white space because I didn't think that I was with white people. White people were in England, and
right,
I was
right.
so glad I wasn't in England.
Well, and I want to mention this because in my introduction of you, and when I identify you through the rest of this interview,
mm-hmm.
I say Antiguan American.
Yes.
And I did so because I think that is something that is, it is so elemental.
Yes. It is. And I, if you were to say I was just an American, because I very much identify myself with the African American experience. A lot of us who are black and from North America are very sometimes too interested in separating ourselves from the African American experience. And I was very, very clear that I didn't want to do that, that I, except for where the ships stopped, we have the same experience of origins,
mm-hmm.
More or less, the African continent. So when I came to America, I steeped myself in African American history. So, I mean, if you want, I can give you a small lecture on Thomas Jefferson or George Washington.
Right,
I was, or Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
I was very aware that I, to say Antiguan American is quite all right, but to call me an African American or a Black American mm-hmm. is perfect also.
Okay. So as you're talking about what you read, what you learned about, Jane Eyre, you mentioned,
yes.
that was also something that I came to at about 12, I think.
Yes.
And I also had the same sort of aspiration looking at the character of Jane.
Yes.
You know, becoming
a writer.
She's
a girl's girl.
Indeed. And so as you were thinking about what to write, and Annie John was... was it a novel that you wrote about a child who is in Antigua.
Mm-hmm.
It is part of the reason you wrote that book, because of what you had not ever seen before, or something that you wanted to represent in a very personal way?
Well, I was very hurt by my mother's treatment of me, of sending me away from her. My life is so wrapped up in with hers. I mean, for instance, the reason I'm so attached, I believe I'm so attached to books, is because she was a great reader herself. And by the time I was 3.5 years of age, I could read anything. And because she had taught me to read, mm-hmm. there was one problem with the way she taught me to read. She hadn't taught me that there was an alphabet. So when I went to school when I was 3.5, and she told me to, if they ever asked, to say I am 5, which in retrospect I consider my first act of fiction and not to mention lying.
Mm-hmm.
So I 3.5, and I go to school with people who are just learning to read, and I can read the whole thing, and I can even make observations about the whole thing. But the alphabet was especially a problem, because I already knew the words, and there were 26 letters. My mother hadn't told me that. But even worse, she hadn't told me about vowels. I still to this day find vowels very intriguing. I will tell you this just a little about me and writing and reading. There was a book we were being read, being taught to read from, about a farmer and his dog and his cat, Miss Tibbs and Mr. Dan, and he had a hen with 12 chicks. 11 were little golden chicks. One was black, and his name was Percy, and he was the only one who had a name. And he was always getting in trouble, and his parents were always... his mother was always worried about him.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to fly up to the top bar of the fence, and she warned him not to. One day he succeeded, and after a minute or so, he fell down and broke. And I cannot remember whether it's his wing or his leg, but the sentence was, Percy the chick had a fall. And I don't know why that haunted me, but about 2 years or so later, when I was punished by my for something I had done, and the punishment was to copy books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost. I was 7 years of age, and I identified Percy the chick had the fall with Lucifer.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
Which, as you can, if you go on, you see I wrote a book with the title Lucy.
Lucy, right.
Yes.
Oh, that is the origin. So before we go much further, I do want to mention a little bit about Annie John, for
yes.
those who are not familiar. It is a coming-of-age novel, and it is one that is autobiographical.
Very.
Right?
Yes.
As you were talking about... stealing the books,
yes,
and and lying about age and that sort of thing. It reminded me of what I was reading in Annie John, and there's one particular portion of it wherein she is writing an essay, and it is one that it's an essay that is not in Annie's mind as imaginative or fun as the other children's essays, but it is very direct. Would you say that the line about Percy sort of informed the way that you write in that way?
Oh, most likely. You know, I hadn't thought of that so directly. The one thing I can say with some accuracy, I think, about my work as a whole, it makes a complete whole more than I would like it to be, because so much of my writing is drawn from not just my life and things that happened, but from things that I could see historically or came across historically. For instance, you know, Christopher Columbus, Ferdinand and Isabella, all of that knowledge of an association with things, with history, informs my writing. For instance, the Percy, the Chick had a fall, and the copying of books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost, which even at that age, a line in it, you know, better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven, I understood it very well. I understood it in some way. Of course, a seven-year-old can't put into action, but I've... It's two lines that to this day inform, you know, inform my way of going through the world. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be dead than do that.
Right.
Do something. So you ask about Annie John. I think so much of the way my ethical education came so much from my mother, who in many ways was a very cruel person. When she died, none of us were speaking to her. None of her children were speaking to her, because she'd done incredible harm to us in some way. On the other hand, had given us gifts that made us able to survive in strange circumstances. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, it leaves a lot to explore further. We will take a very short break here, but we will be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about Annie John, about your relationship with your mother. And before we talk about A Small Place, there is something that I was, I confess, I was excited to discover, which is that we have something in common, which is our given name.
Oh, really?
And so Elaine is a name that I've come around to since I was a child. But when I was a kid, speaking of alphabet, and we were learning cursive, I did not like my name, partly because the capital E just looks so floppy.
Wow.
But you changed your name.
Yes.
To Jamaica Kincaid for a much more serious reason. Tell me about that.
Well, started to write. I'd gone to briefly a college, a hippie college in New Hampshire. I love hippie life. So I went to college, and I was studying photography, but I would write out my photographs, even if they were snapshots. I would write out what they were going to be. Mm. And it got so that it seemed as if I was a writer. And one day I just packed up my car and drove to New York and parked it somewhere and slept on people's couches and said I was a writer. But I was writing and going to write about my family, and I was sure pretty much I would fail because I'd never written before. But a failure has never really been an impediment. I didn't know what success was, so how could I know what failure was? So I started to write, and I didn't want them to know, A, that I was writing about them, and B, that I was a failure at it. So I changed my name. But when I started to publish in the New Yorker about what it was like early in the morning on this island in the West Indies, I hadn't named it, there was a... someone volunteering for a charity. Oh, It's gold. Anyway, they read The New Yorker and was intrigued by this person, the streets. I had named the streets. And they soon found my parents, who then found I was writing. And but by that time, I had stopped speaking to my parents anyway, my mother especially, mm-hmm. because for a long time, I carried a deep pain and a grudge, if you like, mm-hmm. against her for interfering with my education. I might never have amounted to anything because I lived in a British colony. What do you do with an educated person? Mm-hmm. You know, they become a nurse or a teacher, which is very valuable, but invariably they would leave for England or America, which would pay better. Mm-hmm. You know, I just felt really angry that this had been done to me. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped speaking to them. And while I was a nanny or servant or whatever I was, I spent all my salary on expensive clothes. I used to shop at Bunwood Teller, which is a very expensive store. I still have the clothes. Mm-hmm. They won't now even fit my finger. I was, right. I was very angry at and early on, you know, when my brothers were born, my parents, my stepfather and my mother would say one was going to be the prime minister, one was going to be a doctor, one was going to be, they were all going to be distinguished. And I had never heard them say anything like that about me.
About you.
And I'd never heard of feminism or anything like that, but I thought there was something, why wasn't I chosen to be something distinguished? Mm-hmm. And the idea that my education was interrupted and I was just cast away, I never quite got over it. It doesn't bother me now. It all turned out to have had a silver lining, but a silver lining that I made myself. I'm very clear, because there are times when my mother would, when I would tell her about this, and she'd say, but it was all for the good. And I would say to her, no, it was for the good that I made of it.
Mm-hmm. So the work, A Small Place.
Yes.
Is 1988. And it is different in that it is a work of creative nonfiction.
Yes.
Like the coming-of-age novel, autobiographical.
Yes.
Annie John. It is a book-length essay. And by the time it was 1988, you'd been living in the United States for about 23 years.
Yes.
And then you've talked about the name change. But were you writing parts of A Small Place in some way, even before you left Antigua, when you were Elaine and not yet Jamaica?
Huh, I don't know. It's true that I came from my mother again. It was very political, very left-wing, you would say now. But, I mean, for instance, she was the one who taught me never to sing Rule Britannia. Britannia rule the waves, Britons never ever shall be slaves. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, we were not Britons and we were slaves. That book was written, as I remember writing it, was I had an editor, the editor of The New Yorker, William Shawn. The generation of writers, young writers that I was a part of, and I was the only black person there, man or woman, they were all young white men who had gone to Harvard and Yale.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't notice that they were white or men, or we were all friends and they were all wonderful to me. But in any case, we all loved telling Mr. Shawn things, because he had a very peculiar way with the world. He was very phobic, So he never really went anywhere. And so we loved telling him things. And so I wanted to tell him what I really was like. And so I wrote this when I returned to Antigua after such a long time with my daughter. I wanted to tell him what my life was like. So I wrote this essay solely for him. And he loved it and wanted to print it right away. But just as he was about to print it, he was dismissed. He was fired by Mr. Cy Newhouse, who owned the New Yorker then. Mm-hmm. And he was replaced by a man named Robert Gottlieb, who everyone thinks of with much admiration. I don't. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Gottlieb said that he couldn't publish it because it would offend the advertisers. And we, the writers, had never heard of the advertisers. They weren't allowed on our floor. Mm. The people who sold ads weren't allowed to be with the writers. So when Mr. Sean learned of this, he called up Roger Strauss of Farrar, Strauss and Drew and told Roger it should be published as a book. Mm-hmm. And that was how it became a book. But it was meant to be an essay.
Right.
And it became it's very odd how these things work. You know, it became important because of not being because of its strange. It was censored, in fact. It was censored. Mm-hmm. And so it became important. At the time it was published, the reviews were savage. In 1988, the tourist, who would usually be a white person, did not like to hear that they were not a force for good in the world. Mm-hmm. In that way. You know, the language of that we now use, this word colonialism, in 1988 you didn't hear it so much. You didn't hear, I don't think, you can go look. I mean, it would be interesting to look to see how often the word colonialism occurred in America, mm-hmm. in a negative way.
Yeah.
Because colonials are, you know, the people, George Washington before the revolution, the colonial life is before the revolution. Mm-hmm. For us, colonial life was a nightmare and continues to be.
Well, with all of the very serious subject matter, the history that your work has addressed, there are those things that give you life.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is gardening.
Yes.
The passion for plants and flowers. It is well known. And your love of travel also. Your trip here, you said that it's perhaps your third one, afforded finally an opportunity to visit the Missouri Botanical Garden.
Yes.
What did you think, Jamaica?
What do I think? I thought it was the best botanical garden I have ever visited. And and I visited a lot of botanical gardens. I've been to Kew Gardens many times. And something that people don't like, certainly the English don't like to admit about Kew Gardens, is that it basically was like an extension service. You know, they sent plants from all over various parts of the world and cultivated them and then sent them to other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, tea is... what did the English drink before tea? Tea is Chinese. They mm-hmm. got tea from China, sent it to India, and then introduced it. It changed British culture. They sent breadfruit to the West Indies as a easily cultivated food for slaves. They sent... the thing you know as the grapefruit was another fruit from, I think, New Guinea or somewhere around there, sent it to Jamaica. It spore. There's something that plants will do. They will become mm-hmm. something else. It's called a sport of nature.
Mm-hmm.
The grapefruit comes from that. The grapefruit is a sport of this something called the ugly fruit. Mm-hmm. It's from the South Pacific.
Right.
So Kew Gardens is really an extension station. And the Botanic Garden only develops into a botanic garden maybe in the last 100 years. The first one, I think, is in Padua, where they tried to grow bananas, in Padua, mm-hmm. Italy. But I go to these places out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And the curiosity I had as a child, you know, when I was five and I was being taught to read and I already knew how to read, I would just wander off into other things and try to wonder what that's about. I wonder what that's about. And this continues to this day. So mm-hmm. I will go off and just wander around a botanic garden and see this, that and the other and go home and think about it and then make connections to things. I don't want to speak too highly of myself because I'm not well anything at all, but I have this strange ability to sort of seek things out and try to see if they're connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for instance, we are talking about Christopher Columbus, and I will read his journals. I love reading his journals, especially the journal of the first voyage. And then somehow later I'll be reading something about Tudor history. And then I'll go, oh, my God, but the King and Queen of Spain sent their daughter to the Tudor court. She marries Henry. They get a divorce. It caused a schism in the Catholic Church. But that's all starting in 1492. But it's something that if you are talking about how horrible Columbus is, which, by the way, he was a disagreeable man, but he was not. It's the King and Queen of Spain we mm-hmm. should blame, not... Mm-hmm.
Not Columbus.
No. he was sent back to Spain on his last voyage as a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very unsatisfactory end.
Yes. So clearly there's so much to talk about.
I know. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. I wish we had more time. But the reason that you have come to St. Louis again is to receive this award, the St. Louis Literary Award. And it strives to award authors who, quote, deepen our understanding, our insight into the human condition, and by expanding our scope of compassion. Very quickly, in the last minute or so, Jamaica, in what ways do you hope that you have illuminated the human condition?
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't dare say that I have done such a thing. If anything, I may have thrown a cloud in the clarity of the human condition, but I am deeply honored, surprised. I actually thought when I... was told this was a prank. This is a prank because, you know, but I'm very honored, and the list of distinguished people, I can hardly believe I'm among them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very grateful, and I accept with, I hope, humility. Secretly, I'm incredibly proud of it.
don't make it a secret. And you have indeed helped illuminate the human condition. I very much enjoyed your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
This episode was produced by Elaine Cha.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, providing more than 41,000 jobs in the production of wood pallets, railroad ties, white oak barrels, hardwood floors, and more. Details at choosewood.com.